He is currently the director of Southwest Counseling in Littleton, Colorado, where he has been the director for 17 years. He oversees 27 counselors, and they do over 15,000 hours of counseling every year. We're very excited to have Doug here with us, and he's going to help us to try to understand depression, suicide, how this could help you if this is something you struggle with, as well as ways that you can help those around you that may have been affected by this or are struggling with it themselves. So I'm going to go ahead and move this stuff over, and then Doug will come up, and we'll get started.
Well, hello, everyone. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule to be here. And I look forward to getting to know you. So tonight, we're going to start by all of you taking a test. So those of you who are students are going to be comfortable. Those who are not, don't worry. I'm not going to grade them. I'm not going to see them. You're going to take the test. You're going to keep the test yourself. Whatever answers you put, and tomorrow afternoon at the end of our workshop, I'm going to ask you to go through pull your test back out, and we'll review all the answers. So before we're done tomorrow, you'll know all the right answers, whether you put the right answers first or not. But it would help you, I think, to understand and prepare what our topic's going to be. It's really hard to talk about depression and suicide for hours and not have everybody get depressed, right? I mean, at the end of this, it's a heavy subject. It's hard to listen to. It's hard to think about. And if any of you know people who've committed suicide or attempted to commit suicide, there's a heaviness with that. For my sake, just raise your hand if you've known anybody who's either attempted suicide or committed suicide. Do any of you know? If you turn around, you'll see almost everybody in this room. So as we talk about it, there's painful memories too. But what we're talking about will save a life. In many ways, this is like first aid training, CPR, how to help somebody when they have a heart attack. Learning about depression and suicide will help you save a life. And so we're going to talk more about that as we go along. So the first step I'd like to ask you to do is take that questionnaire you were given when you walked in, and please take about 20 minutes. I'll watch the clock and just see how far you get. Don't worry about getting all the way through to the end. Tonight or tomorrow morning, if you want to finish it, you can. But I do want you to bring the test with you tomorrow, so at the end of the day, we can go through the test and the answers. But at least for now, please take a few minutes and just do the best you can, and I'll watch the time here. Does that seem easy or difficult? Difficult. Please hold on to your tests. Bring them back tomorrow. If you didn't get all the way through and you want to finish, please feel free to do so tonight at home or tomorrow. And tomorrow afternoon, we'll go through the questions and the answers. So what I hope is at the end of our time, you'll read a quiz like that and you go, oh, that's simple, and you'll be able to go very quickly. And if you're not able to do that, blame me. It's because I didn't teach you very well, all right? So it's good to learn and hopefully be able to apply what we're learning. So the others are going to help you now and pass out a separate form, which is an outline. Please hang on to your pen if you would like, so that way you could take notes as you go along. But this is the outline of the talk that we'll be using for the rest of the night tonight and tomorrow to give you an idea of what we're going to be covering together. So when you study suicide and you begin to see how frequent and common it really is, you realize that it is a very serious problem all around the world. And in the United States alone, there are 33,000 actual suicides every year, which is a scary number. And of young people in America, suicide is the second highest killer of children from ages 15 to 19. Accidents are number one, meaning could be car accidents or some other kind of accident. Suicide is number two. It's a serious problem around the world. When you look worldwide, the average suicide rate is 16 suicides every year for every 100,000 people. How many people live in Galway or in this region? Is it around 100,000? So if you think of Galway with that number, every year on average about 16 people will kill themselves, which is a scary number if you think about it. And in Ireland has one of the highest suicide rates amongst youth in the whole EU. In fact, they were fourth worst in all of the EU. They did a survey of young people in Ireland from ages 15 to 19, and they had a suicide rate of about 10.5 for every 100,000 young people. So it's obviously a serious problem. I brought one article I'll leave up here if any of you want to look at it, specifically about Ireland and some of the statistics. But it's a worldwide serious problem. Part of what's scary, too, is for every one successful suicide, on average, there are 20 to 25 attempted suicide. So when you think about how many people that is, we're talking about hundreds of people every year are attempting suicide. So part of the idea is, how do we as people respond? If we struggle ourselves with this, or if we're trying to help other people, how do we respond to this? And so that's what we hope to cover tonight and tomorrow with you. What are the causes of suicide? What would you guess is the number one cause of that leads to suicide attempts in people? The number one cause is depression. And they've done worldwide surveys to find, of all the illnesses in the world that are the most common, depression is the number one illness throughout the world. And I know surveys in America found one out of every five Americans are depressed at any point in time. Now, depression is not just I feel sad or I'm kind of melancholy. Depression is a serious illness because it debilitates. When people get depressed, they have a hard time motivating or even trying to do anything. And we're going to talk a little bit more tonight about depression. Other things that contribute to depression are things like poverty can contribute. The article about suicide in Ireland said about 18% of youth in Ireland live at a poverty level. And that's a significant reason behind why suicide rates amongst youth are sometimes an issue. Worldview is a problem. If you based your life, say, on your family, and your family was stable, like a big part of your identity, and all of a sudden your parents divorce or a parent leaves or dies, and your whole world is shaken and you're not sure what direction to go with your life, that can, again, be incredibly disruptive and, especially for young people, cause a real problem of how to live. But depression is still the major problem. So we're going to talk a little bit about depression. What are some of the symptoms of real clinical depression? Not just feeling down, but actual clinical depression. What are you all familiar with? What are some thoughts you might have about what is depression? If you see somebody, what are you looking for to say, oh, they're depressed? What symptoms are you looking for? Hopelessness, definitely. In fact, that's even advanced on it. If you think about depression as a continuum from somebody just is low-level depression, just a little bit depressed, all the way to very high, very severe depression. And kind of as you go higher up, the symptoms change. Hopelessness is way up here, and we're going to talk more about it. When people get hopeless, their depression is bad enough that they have a hard time even thinking or reasoning. Their reasoning breaks down. They're no longer able to think in a normal way, that kind of thing. What does low-level depression look like? Well, for most people, it's just kind of a lethargic, like a dullness. They have a hard time motivating. They just don't kind of lose interest in things. They have a hard time just getting excited about anything. They don't smile as much anymore. Things are in a more dulled and lethargic way. As they go higher on the continuum, it gets more and more severe. Now, men and women tend to react to this more severe depression differently, and we think it's because men have testosterone and women don't. So often, or they have low levels. So when depression gets higher, often women feel more hopeless, lay in bed, have a hard time getting off the couch, harder and harder time taking care of the kids or getting in, going to the grocery store feels overwhelming. And as it gets higher, even the thought of taking a shower just feels, or doing your hair feels like too much. It's almost like you're in quicksand just trying to go through the day. Does this make sense? Could any of you relate to this? For men, often as men go higher, they get more angry, more irritable, more aggressive, more impatient. It's like we lose the ability to control our emotion and our actions, and we get more and more out of control that way. And so it's not unusual for men or women as they get depressed to start drinking more and to just quit taking care of themselves. And as depression goes higher and higher. Now, we know that depression, again, this kind of depression is a serious problem and the number one illness in the world, in every country that's been studied. And of this depression, there's really two types. One type of depression, which is about 25%, is biological. And I'm going to explain that a little more in a couple minutes here. About 75% is situational, meaning life gets hard. Your loved one dies. You lose a job. You had a boyfriend and you broke up. Something hard happened in your life. And because you're struggling or suffering due to a situation that you're going through in life, you begin to get more and more depressed. You begin to spiral down. And this kind of depression, as we go higher and higher, really becomes a type of a spiral where it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. So we may be on the low side here, but we feel more hopeless. Gee, I couldn't try very much. And so we get more and more depressed, and our own thinking causes us to become depressed, and it gets worse and worse, and the depression gets deeper and deeper. So if you don't challenge depression, or if you don't do something about it, like in an airplane, they have an autopilot where the pilot can set it and the plane will fly itself and the pilot can just supervise the plane. There it's flying nice and level. Depression isn't like that. If you don't do anything about it, it will get worse. It will continue to go down deeper and deeper. And so that's one of the things that makes depression difficult. And so you have to do something about it. When you're getting depressed, or someone you know or love is getting depressed, you have to do something to help them. If you don't help yourself or them, it will tend to spiral itself down. Now, once in a while, it'll bounce back. So, you know, I had a breakup with my boyfriend or girlfriend. I don't think I'll ever find anybody again. Nobody will love me. Things feel so hopeless. And then eventually you meet somebody new and now you feel better. Or you lost a job and then you got a new job, you begin to feel better. Sometimes circumstances will change to help lift up, but many times it won't. Even if you get a new job, now you don't even want to go because you're thinking, well, they'd probably fire me anyway. Or, you know, gee, I thought I was going to marry that girlfriend and she left me. So, yeah, I may have another girlfriend, but how do I know she's not going to leave me? And so the spiral could continue. Does that make sense? So I said here that that's the situational. About 25% of depression is chemical, meaning it's in the body, it's physical. And often it's genetic, which means, that you'll be able to trace it in the family. I can use my wife's, that's my wife Joyce in the back there, my wife's family as an example. Her mom had severe depression and was the genetic depression type. And you could trace it back in her family. Maybe her grandma or grandpa, you can see uncles and aunts. You can see a family history where different parts in the family had depression, and it came down to her mom who had severe depression. She ended up being in the psychiatric hospital multiple times and had a very severe depression. And because we could track it back through the family and see different people historically who had depression, we could know that a lot of it for her mom was biological. Now, her mom had had very difficult things happen to her as well. It wasn't just chemical, but there was a very strong chemical or genetic component. So when somebody struggling with depression, it's always worth taking time to ask questions. How long have they been depressed? How long have they noticed it? Anybody in their family show any kind of depression or tendencies like that? Suicidal behavior is not genetic, but depression is, about 25% of the time. So let me try to explain what that means. Now, be patient with me. I'll try to explain it, but then I want to show you why that matters. So in our bodies, when we have nerve cells that are it's not the exact shape, obviously, and some of you may be in medical school and know better, but they're nerve cells like this. And when we have a message sent from another part of our body, it goes through the nerve cell system to our brain, and our brain says, oh, this is what's going on, and gives a command what to do. So if I pinch my finger and I feel the pinch, I'm sending messages through my nerve cells saying there's pressure on your left hand, do something. And the brain is saying, Doug, do something. Get your finger out of the way of the pain. Now, the messages, if you look at like the lighting for the electronics or the soundboard with the coaxial cable, when we make cables to carry electricity or sound, those cables are solid. They're not broken up like this. They're solid. And so you turn the light switch on and the electricity runs over to the light to make the light shine. But our bodies are not like that. They're not solid. They're broken separate, which is really cool. I think how God designed our bodies is amazing because it really becomes more like a fiber optic system, if you know what fiber optics, how they're different from standard wiring. So when our body gets a signal, like I said, it could be a pressure from the finger, it could be pain, it could be heat or cold. When something happens, it starts at the end of a nerve cell, and electronically it zips across here. Now this happens obviously incredibly fast. How long from when you begin to pinch your finger does your brain tell you do something about it? It's just like that. It's so quick, right? It moves so fast. But the message goes across the nerve cell. Now it comes to this gap. And this gap has a name. The name is called a synapse. A synapse is these gaps between each nerve cell. And so the message comes across, and it triggers on the end something I like to call a chemical motorboat. You know, think of it as a little motorboat. So the message comes across, and say the message is pain. It triggers the pain motorboat. It zips across this little chemical synapse. It docks in the pain dock over here. And so the message continues, and it does the same thing like that. All right? After the pain boat, motorboat, delivers the message at the pain dock, it releases. And it just kind of floats around in this synapse for a little while. And each cell has a little pump on it, called a reuptake pump. So each cell, after the pain message is delivered, the pain motorboat floats around a little bit. Eventually, it gets sucked back into the cell, and it lines up in the pain motorboat line, waiting for the next time it's needed. How cool is that? And so then they're all lined up here, and that way you can send a message of pain, but you can get multiple messages coming over and over because there's multiple motorboats zipping across there. And when it releases, it floats, and then it sucks back in. There's a famous man, you may not understand American football a whole lot, but a famous man who was a well-known coach in American football. And he and his wife had a son who felt no pain. Or he's still alive, but he feels no pain. So think about that. You don't have the pain message because you don't have the pain motorboat. Since there's no motorboat there, there's no pain. And in the book, Tony Dungy's name, in the book, he describes how hard it is to raise a child who doesn't feel pain. And they use the example of their son will be standing in the kitchen with his hand on the stove, the hot stove burner, and because he feels no pain, he doesn't move his hand, but the parents could smell the flesh burning and tell him, oh, you know, and make him move his hand, and then his hand was burned, but he didn't feel it. Wouldn't that be strange? Can you imagine trying to grow up without feeling pain? Well, the problem was he didn't have this pain motorboat to carry the message across, the synapse to trigger the next message. Does that make sense, or am I clear here? What does this have to do with depression? Well, there's a particular chemical motorboat called serotonin. Serotonin is a chemical motorboat that goes from between here that tells us we're happy, we feel good, we're content. It's a message of pleasure and contentment. And when we're feeling happy and glad and relieved, these chemical motorboats, the fancy name is called neurotransmitters. It's a big, long name, and like there's many, many different kinds of neurotransmitters, or as I like to call them, chemical motorboats. And serotonin is the one that has to do with depression. So when serotonin is being sent, we feel good. when serotonin is not being sent, we begin to feel depressed and down. So what happens with serotonin? Well, when we're feeling good, when we feel happy or pleasure, we laugh, we're enjoying a pleasant moment, the message goes across, hey, I'm having a nice time, it feels good. It releases the feel-good serotonin motorboat to the next one, and that continues the message on. Well, the motorboat, after it docks at the happy dock, would you rather go to the happy dock or the pain dock? But it goes to the happy dock, or feel content. It releases, and it floats around for a while, and then eventually it gets sucked back in and lines up again where the serotonin neurotransmitters or motorboats are. Now, what have they found biologically causes depression, is that in the synapse, in this chemical area, the serotonin level goes low. In other words, after the message is delivered, hey, I'm enjoying myself, I feel good, and it releases and it floats for a while, it gets sucked up too quickly. It doesn't linger long enough. And because of that, the little reuptake pump that brings it back in does too good of a job. And so the free-floating serotonin in this area goes low. And when it goes low, we feel depressed. Now, does that make sense? Am I making sense so far? What causes that? Why does serotonin go too low? Well, last time I researched that, there were 250 different theories. So pick a theory. I don't figure I have to know why. I just need to know that's what's happening. And so when people are depressed, one thing you could know right away is that this chemical is too low there. And sometimes it's called caused genetically, like my wife's mom, because her body just didn't produce enough serotonin to begin with. It just didn't generate enough as it began. So have you heard of antidepressant medication? The main kind of antidepressant medication that's used now is the initials are SSRI. And that stands for selective serotonin. Here's where serotonin is. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Reuptake, remember, is the pump. So what it's saying is it only targets serotonin, and antidepressant medication makes this pump slow down. So it doesn't do as good of a job of sucking the serotonin out of the synapse. It actually makes more serotonin float in the synapse before it gets pulled back into the nerve cell. So selective serotonin, meaning it doesn't do this with other neurotransmitters or chemical motorboats, only serotonin ones, and it makes the pump, it inhibits the pump, it slows it down, it makes it so it doesn't work as efficiently. And by doing that, these medications are the most effective medications we have now to treat depression. They work quite well for most people. Do anybody have questions on that so far? Hopefully I haven't just lost you. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so what are the two possibilities? Yeah, serotonin levels could go down biologically because your body doesn't produce enough. Or when situations are hard, you're not getting enough messages saying, I feel good. You get fewer and fewer of those messages, so there's less and less serotonin that floats in the middle there. you're not feeling good when you just lost your job, or you don't know how you can pay the bills, and you're scared, or you just got diagnosed with an illness and you're scared what that'll mean, you're not sending serotonin because you're not feeling good. You're feeling sad. So, but serotonin levels then gradually drop and people feel more and more depressed. So that's a good question. Any other questions before I go on? Yeah. Yeah. Can you check the levels of serotonin? Great question. So far, there's no good test to measure chemical level of serotonin. We know that's what causes it. Wish we had a blood test or some kind of, you know, PET scan or something, but so far it hasn't been developed. And that's part of, it's very complex, obviously, but we all keep hoping in the counseling field, we'd love that, where we could send a depressed person, have a particular test done, and then we know, okay, the serotonin is too low. To make matters a little more complicated is there are 5 different types of serotonin. So 5 different serotonin motorboats. So when somebody's depressed and it's too low, it could be any combination of these 5. So it gets even more complicated. And different medications affect different serotonin neurotransmitters. And so, again, a blood test would be really nice to say, these 2 serotonins are low. Let's give them the medication that just works with that. What they've done is they've created, right now there's about 10 or 12 mainline SSRI medications. And they all work a little bit different from each other because they're working on different combinations of the 5. So sometimes if somebody's depressed and goes sees a doctor or psychiatrist and starts an antidepressant, it's a little bit of a guessing game because the doctor, you know, there's not a blood test to say, okay, it's this. So the doctor has to guess a little bit. And sometimes when people go to see a doctor for depression, this is a big problem because people want to feel better and I'm taking a pill and it isn't helping anything. And the reason is because you feel a little bit like you're being, we would say, a guinea pig. You're being tested, and you've got to be patient. You got to be willing to work with the doctor a little bit because there's different combinations they can try until they find one that works the best for you. So there's a little bit of an experimentation that goes on. So one of my questions then, hopefully one of yours is, okay, not everybody is so depressed that they need medicine, or maybe medicine is a little longer to get to. So are there any natural ways to increase my serotonin level? Would any of you like to increase your serotonin level? Would you like to feel better more, feel depressed less? Well, there are things that God created that help raise our serotonin level. And I'm going to talk briefly about those. And this is one way that you help anybody you know who's depressed. You convince them to start raising their serotonin level. If they'll do that, I promise you the depression will gradually get better. Now, it won't happen usually the next day. It may take a little bit, but they will get better. The way God made our bodies is we could mistreat them and get away with it for a while, you know. If I just eat donuts for a week, I probably won't fall over dead, but I'm sure not helping my body. But eventually, it's going to hurt my body. But it takes a while. So anyway, to raise serotonin and feel better then, I call these the big 5. If you do these 5 things, I promise you, you will raise your serotonin level. That's why I call them the big 5. These are the most important things that if you do these 5 things, you're naturally raising your serotonin level. Number 1, sleep 7 to 9 hours. a night. Doesn't that sound boring? You want to feel less depressed and feel better? You need to sleep. But doctors are very, very clear that sleep is hugely important in order to maximize our body's serotonin level and functioning. Sleep works in our body like rebooting your computer works for your computer. It or tuning up your car would make the engine run better. Sleep is the natural way every day we reboot our body and we reset our brain chemistry, including serotonin. Now, doctors say if you sleep less than 7 or more than 9, unless if you have a medical condition and need to sleep more, but generally speaking, if you sleep less than 7 or more than 9, guess what happens to your serotonin level? Over time, it drops and it drops and it drops. So this number is really a very, very important number. And I always think, how boring. We're trying to solve a big problem, and what's our solution? Well, part of it is sleep, but it makes a big difference. Number two, exercise. Now, obviously, there's a lot of good reasons to exercise. It's good for us health-wise. You can lose weight, build muscle, do a lot of good things. But when it comes to serotonin, we have to exercise at least 3 times a week, minimum, for 30 minutes at least, and it needs to be pretty vigorous. So 30 minutes, 3 times a week, and it needs to be pretty energetic. In other words, you have to raise your heart rate and keep it elevated for 30 minutes. It needs to be cardio kind of exercise. Now, when somebody has a genetic predisposition to depression, like my wife's mom, my mother-in-law, had, she really should exercise 4 or 5 times a week, for at least, because the more you do it, the more serotonin you generate. But this kind of exercise raises serotonin. Now, what's the problem with depression? People who are depressed will say the same thing. I know it would help, but I can't get it. I just don't have the energy. I just can't do it, right? I mean, a lot of us may use that excuse, but when we're depressed, we have to make ourselves. So if you have a friend or somebody you love who's depressed, you make them get up and do something with you. Now, you don't have to go to the gym and do something like that. Maybe make them go out and go for a walk with you. But when you walk, don't walk like this. I'm not raising my heart rate, right? I get to see all of you, that's nice, but it doesn't help my heart rate. You have to walk like fast walking, fast enough to raise the heart rate and keep it elevated for 30 minutes. So if you're walking on the streets and you have to wait at a light until you can safely cross, as long as you don't have to wait too long, but as much as you can, make it continuous. Or you can run, or you can row, or you can ride a bike, a stationary bike or a bicycle on the streets. But do some exercise 30 minutes a day for at least 3 days a week, and you will raise your serotonin and you'll feel better and you'll be less depressed. Third, nutrition. You need to eat healthy. Why? Well, because your body needs healthy fuel to recharge. So remember I said if I eat donuts for a week, I might not feel a lot of negative effect on my body right away. But what I'm doing to my body is terrible, right? And eventually it will hurt my body. So eating healthy overall is hugely important to raise our serotonin level. So that you don't have to be fanatical about it, but you do need to eat healthy. So think about things like sugars, caffeine, some of those things. How do they affect our serotonin level? Well, we know that if we have too much sugar, it raises, we feel a little better, but then we feel depressed. Sugar and caffeine are actually, in the long run, depressants. They drain you down. So in the long run, they'll reduce serotonin. So if you're going to eat healthy, it's okay to have some sugar or caffeine. It doesn't mean don't ever have it, but you better keep it in healthy balance. And if you're prone to depression, you really should get it out of your diet as much as you can. If you're already susceptible to depression to begin with, you should, as much as you can, not only eat healthy, but phase out some of the sugars and caffeines. What's another depressant that a lot of people use? Alcohol. Alcohol is a depressant. Any of us, if we start drinking, maybe after one drink or so, we're feeling okay. We might feel kind of happy or relaxed. But if we keep drinking, the effect of alcohol is to shut our body down. It closes it off. So it depletes serotonin. It reduces it. So again, it doesn't necessarily mean we should never drink alcohol. What it does mean is be very moderate in what you do. And if you're prone to depression to begin with, make sure that you either don't have alcohol at all or just are very, very restricted, because it brings you down. This is one of the big problems with people who use that medication I was talking about earlier, SSRI. Virtually every one of those, if you're on one of those medications, virtually everyone will tell you don't drink any alcohol with it. Because if you take an antidepressant to make your body generate more serotonin, but then you drink alcohol, which makes your body produce less serotonin, you're working against the medication. The medication then can't help you because the alcohol is working against the medication. Does that make sense so far? The fourth one you in Ireland are going to love. This is going to be your favorite one you're going to hear. Sunlight. We've been in Ireland several days, and I don't think I've seen an hour of sun altogether, if I add all of it up. For serotonin levels to go up, we need at least an hour of sunlight a day to boost our serotonin. Now, the sun gives off a lot of different rays to it, some that our skin absorbs, like vitamin D and things like that. But that doesn't help. It's good for our bodies, but it doesn't help serotonin. For sunlight to help serotonin, it has to go through our eyes. And if you wear polarizing sunglasses, you block those rays. So what little sun you get in Ireland, you won't benefit from. So now that does not mean you go out in the sun and stare at it. Please don't do that. What it does mean is when you're out walking around and the sun's out, don't wear sunglasses for an hour a day anyway. Now, hopefully you have days like that around here. I haven't seen any so far. Why? Because an hour a day of the sunlight raises serotonin. It bumps it up. So what do you do in Ireland? What do you do when you need more sunlight, you're not getting enough sunlight? I don't know if any of you noticed that. When you have a nice sunny day and you just get outside for a little while, do you feel better afterwards? You do, don't you? Well, Denise can help you back there. So she has one of these lights. That's why I say you can talk to Denise. But they make special lights that you can order, and they're called full spectrum lights. And they're special light bulbs that reproduce the same kind of UV rays the sun gives. They do it through a machine, through a light machine. Yeah. What's that? Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to get that in a minute. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'll get to that in a minute. But the name of it is full spectrum in terms of the lights, that the UV rays. Light bulbs like this don't give it off. Computer screens don't give it off. But these lights are specially made to give off the specific rays. So a place like Ireland, this is part of a blessing. You can get more sunlight to improve your serotonin and feel better. Now, what Denise was saying is there's a disorder that is known in medicine, and it's called seasonal affective disorder. Seasonal meaning certain times of the year. Affective meaning emotional. It affects your emotions and your emotional being. Disorder meaning it's messed up, something's off. And the initials for that are SAD, S-A-D, seasonal affective disorder. And so the diagnosis of SAD, or seasonal affective disorder, means you either need more sunlight or you need to get lights like what Denise has. And that's what Denise was saying. They even sell it as a SAD light, whatever they call it, just so you know what you're ordering on Amazon. But I'm telling you what it is and how it works. Now, we come from Colorado, and Colorado gets sunlight year-round. So for us, it's easy. We just go outside. But it's a little harder here. Now, most of you would benefit from this kind of light anyway, but if you don't struggle with depression, you're probably okay. But if you have a depressive tendency or you have friends with a tendency, this is money well spent. Yeah.
Do you have to be outside?
It
doesn't come through
glass? If you're inside the house and you have a tinted or treated window, it won't go through. But if you have just standard windows, it'll come through okay. Yeah. But it still needs to come through the eyes. So, you know, you need to try to make sure that you get enough light hitting the eyes, or else you don't get the benefit. So if you're a little sad and you notice the sun coming through the front window, go outside for a little while. Go take a chair, sit out there, drink a cup of coffee. You'll feel better. Yes? When does it have to? Why? The question was, why does sunlight have to go through the eyes to increase serotonin? My answer is, I don't know. You're smarter than I am. All I know is that is what has to happen. And again, there's thousands of studies. There's been well researched. So, like I said, on any of these things, we can generate theories to try to explain, well, why is that? And there's theories on all of this. But I'm a counselor. I'm not a researcher. I don't necessarily have to sit around to try to make sure I understand all the different theories. I just want to know how to help people. And when I'm talking to somebody who's depressed, what are ways I can help that person? You're a tough crowd. You ask hard questions. Good job back there. Yeah. Specific foods? You know, the government's always changing that. Some of you, I know Mandy's better at this, or my wife would be, or Denise probably. The government keeps changing. You know, the food pyramids that used to be, you need vegetables and you need fruits and protein, they keep changing the charts. But the bottom line is there's no one or, you know, small group of foods. It's just healthy. A balanced, healthy diet is what they would tell you. No. But I love chocolate. I love chocolate too. Chocolate has caffeine and sugar in it. So, you know, enjoy chocolate. I like chocolate. I'm a big chocolate fan, but I better not eat too much of it or it's going to cause problems. But I don't struggle with depression chemically. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I know. If it's dark, yeah, I know I've seen all those, you know, people market it, but every study I've ever seen, nothing has ever put any credibility on that. On a lot of those food things, they sound really good when people are marketing, so you buy their chocolate. But when you actually study it, it's really hard to find actual evidence that this is true. So enjoy chocolate. I like it too, but don't convince yourself of something. So this is four. Number five is stress. Stress, just feeling pressured, overwhelmed, worried, struggling with things. And the more stress goes up, serotonin, guess what it happens? What does serotonin do? Yeah, down. When stress goes down, serotonin goes up. So you're a student, you're going through exams, your stress is very, very high. What's happening to your serotonin? It's going down. You're stressing, you're struggling to make it through. You have a high pressure at work. There's something hard you're dealing with. It takes your serotonin level down. Now, we can all do okay for short periods like that. But when people are struggling with depression, one of the things you always want to ask them, get them talking about, is what are they stressed by? What's worrying them? What's pressuring them? What are their stressors? And see if you can help reduce their stress somehow or convince them to help reduce their stress. Because if that happens, their serotonin levels increase, whether they know it or not. So, you know, we all go through periods of stress, but we should be looking at our lifestyle and making sure that we're taking days off, that we're, you know, the things like the sleep and all, that we're resting, that we take time to do leisure things, things that we enjoy that relax us a little bit, in order to maximize our serotonin. Does this make any sense at all? So if I could convince all of you tonight in your own life and in the life of anybody you know who may struggle with depression, if they say to you, well, what can I do about it? What's one thing you can say right away? Go to sleep, eat healthy, get some exercise, find a way in Ireland to get some sunlight or something like it, and reduce your stress. And they may say, what does that have to do with depression? How does that, I'm depressed because I feel hopeless. And your answer would be, well, because that helps your body feel better and fight the depression. Now, it doesn't solve their problems. We're going to talk more about what other steps we need to take. So it doesn't fix their problem, but what it does do is raise serotonin level and help lighten the load, ease the depression, feel better. Now, notice where on here does it say crack a joke? Watch a comedy show. One of the things that has driven me crazy is when I, in my counseling, when I see clients who are struggling with depression, they will have gone and talked to somebody and the person said, well, you just need to laugh more. Watch a comedy show. But that's nowhere on here, right? And didn't list comedy shows. That doesn't really help. I mean, it's okay to laugh a little bit, but it doesn't solve any kind of problem. But these things will help correct some of the biology of depression, which in turn will help people feel less suicidal. So when I see in counseling people who are really depressed or maybe suicidal, I'm always asking about these five things. And I'm always telling them, how are you doing in each of these? And if there's an area you're not doing or more than one, this is something you need to do. I told you in my mother-in-law, my wife's mom, we saw a clear genetic tendency toward depression. And my wife doesn't have it, nor her brother or sister, but we have three daughters. They're grown now. They're in their 30s. And we noticed our oldest daughter had a depressive tendency. We could see it in her. When she would feel stressed or whatever, she would isolate, she would withdraw. We really began noticing it in high school already. And we could see that she had the genetics, just kind of the natural lower level serotonin levels with how she lived. And so I remember when she was in college, my wife and I were really concerned. She was acting more and more depressed and isolating more, studying all the time and not really doing much of anything. I wrote her a long letter. This was before email days. And saying, because of grandma and what we know happened with grandma's issues and that there's a genetic tendency, you need to be aware that you've got to take good care of yourself and make sure your serotonin levels stay up so that you don't slip deeper and deeper into depression. Remember, it's a spiral. It'll get worse and worse. And our daughter took it to heart, and she changed. And for now we are many years later. She's married, and she's living a good, full life. But she is excellent at these things. She takes it very seriously. And because of that, she's not struggled with depression. And conversely, my mother-in-law, there are some of these things she didn't do very well. And now she had a severe enough depression, it wouldn't have been enough. She needed to be on medication too. But had she been more vigorous about these things and the medication, it would have helped her a lot. So we're going to take a five-minute break. I don't know if any of you can use the restrooms. Russ explained them. There's drinks here. And in about 5 minutes, we'll pick up a little bit, okay? If any of you have questions, feel free to come forward. All right, can I have everybody's attention? Unless some of you want to teach the class. Anybody want to teach the class today? So if as we go along, you're following in your outline, we're starting at number 3.5. That's where I am right now, if you're able to follow along. Front page, Roman numeral 3, point number 5, downward spiral. That's where we are right now. Boy, you calmed down so quickly. That's very good. I'm impressed. So anyway, I've already mentioned, by the way, I changed colors. Hopefully it'll be a little easier to read, but it doesn't help my handwriting, but maybe it'll help you see it better. So again, the point about depression is that the more somebody is depressed, the deeper and deeper they will go if they don't challenge it. If you just let it go, it'll go from low level of depression to a very high or more serious level of depression. So it'll begin down where I kind of feel sad, maybe a little lonely, or I'm really aggrieved over something. But if I don't do something about it, I get more and more lethargic. I get less and less active. I'll begin to feel less and less good about myself. Then if I quit, maybe I don't take care of myself. My self-care gets worse. Now I don't even like myself because I used to get up in the morning and get myself going. Now I can't even do that. And every day I don't do that makes it worse and worse, and I feel worse, and I go, what's my problem? And then my thinking begins to change, where I'll begin to think things like, it'll never get any better. I can't help myself. So the thinking goes dark. It goes more and more negative. And so it's a downward spiral. It just keeps pulling us further and further down. And we gradually, over time, we feel more and more helpless, more and more hopeless. We have a harder and harder time to motivate ourselves. So like I said about exercise earlier, when somebody's getting more and more depressed as they go down, and you tell them, come on, we need to get out and get 30 minutes of exercise 3 or 4 times a week, what are they going to tell you when they look at you? I can't even shower in the morning. How am I supposed to go do that? Why? Because they've come down deeper and deeper. So you need to help move them up. So if they can't exercise for 30 minutes, help them exercise for 5 minutes. Say, get up and let's get started. Because as people begin to realize that they can help themselves, they'll begin to feel better and better. So maybe along the way, as they feel more negative and hopeless, when you give them some hope, sometimes that can help start pulling them up. Well, maybe, yeah, if I do go walk for 5 minutes, or if I do just sleep 7 to 9 hours and I just get my good rest, you know, the truth is I do feel better, so why don't I try it? And they slowly will help themselves gradually climb out of this hole. This is what makes depression so dangerous. If you don't take it on, it just gets deeper and deeper. And this is where suicidal thinking can begin to develop as we go further into depression. Yes? Yeah, we're going to talk a lot more about that, how to convince somebody or help them do it. Sometimes you make them. You know, you drag them out of bed and you say, I don't care, you're coming with me. Other times, hopefully they're not that bad and you're going to try to say, come on, no, let's go do something together. I want you to go to the store with me. Let's go to, you know, the playground with the recess and take a break. You're kind of trying to entice them and gradually motivate them. Sometimes if it gets real serious, you don't want to be gentle with people. You want to make them do it. You want to say, you know, you're in trouble. You're really depressed right now. You can't just let yourself stay depressed because it's going to keep getting worse. When was the last time somebody who was really depressed felt better by doing nothing and feeling depressed? Do you know anybody that ever helped? I don't either. And of course, in counseling, a lot of times people come to see me as a counselor, one of my team, and they I don't want to be here. My wife, my husband, my mom, my dad, somebody, they made me come, but it doesn't do any good. What good is talking to somebody going to do to help with it be less depressed? That won't do any good. And so they come feeling really negative and hopeless and stuck, like they can't help themselves. And so beginning to try to help them climb back up the other direction begins in very small steps sometimes. I've had people literally tell me for the next hour, what are you going to do? And the more suicidal they get, which we're going to talk more and more about as we go along, the more you literally have to sometimes walk them through an hour at a time. If you talk about the next couple of days, it's overwhelming. So think of this as a downward spiral, and you need to help people slowly come back up. Telling them a joke won't jump it up, but doing nothing is terrible because they continue to slide down. So you have to try to in different ways help them along. There's been a lot of studies, it's called positive psychology, a lot of studies on things like hope. And it may seem kind of obvious to all of us, but how do you study? Does hope really, giving a person hope, does that really help them feel less depressed? Yes or no? Probably most of us would say, yeah, that's got to be true. And certainly as a Christian, we know the Bible talks a lot about hope being a good thing. But we may think, oh, that can't really help them very much. But we do know from research, the truth is that if you can help somebody feel a little more hopeful, they get less depressed. It's a way to slowly lift them out of depression. Helping maybe identify what's a stressor in their life that they're really feeling discouraged about. Well, I lost my job and I'll never find another job. Nobody will ever want to hire me again. How do you help somebody like that gradually come back up? Well, giving them a little hope. How do you know that? Have you tried to apply for more jobs and everybody just keeps telling you no? Well, no, I just know that. Okay, well, can we work on your resume or can we get you to go ahead and try to apply for a job and see? I mean, you seem to think nobody will ever hire you again, but I wonder if that's true. You know, doing little things to help reverse the downward spiral. So you need to, in your mind, when you think of depression, think of the spiral or slide down, and you need to try to help people come back up the other direction. That's one of the best things we can do to help people who are depressed, and just try to find different ways to do that. And we're going to talk more about some of those ideas. So we're going to be at the top of page 2 right now, if you're following on the outline. There are other mental illnesses that affect depression and suicidal thinking. Depression is the number one. It's the most serious. But there are some other ones. By the way, alcoholism obviously can. Remember, alcohol is a depressant. It brings people down. So that's another type of problem. People who are alcoholic or addicted to alcohol or drugs can often be very depressed. And it's because of the chemicals on their body. What are other mental illnesses that can affect it? One is bipolar disorder. Do you all know what bipolar disorder is? It used to be called manic depressive, but we name it bipolar now. Bipolar disorder affects people in that they get like really high, like wired. They can't hardly sleep. They're excited. Their mind is racing. They're just going high energy all the time. And then after a little while, they kind of wear out. And then if this is the normal range, this is kind of what normal people feel. You know, some days I feel good and some days I feel down, but I'm kind of in this normal range. A bipolar person will feel extra good, like, wow, life's great. They'll sleep 2 hours or 3 hours. They'll be on the go all the time. Their mind will be racing. They'll be high energy. Sometimes they'll do very weird or bizarre things at that level. Then they'll briefly go through the normal range, and then they will become very, very depressed. This top part is called mania or manic, and the bottom part is depression. So they'll go up and down like this. Where the normal person, we can have our good days and bad days, but it looks kind of like this, you know, more of a normal range to it. A bipolar is swinging up and down, up and down. It is a genetic disorder. It's not caused by environment. It's caused by the chemistry of the brain. Serotonin is one part of it. Dopamine and norepinephrine are others. So these are other neurotransmitters or chemical motorboats that affect it. but manic depressive disorder is a serious disorder with severe depression. And by the way, it has a very high rate of attempted suicide. If you know somebody or you find somebody with a bipolar disorder, it's really, really important to do a couple of things. One, get them to see a doctor and get on the right medication. And number two, they need to become experts at those big five I told you about, where they're sleeping regularly and they're exercising and nutrition and those things that I mentioned before. But bipolar disorder is one mental illness that's serious. It needs medical treatment, and it creates a lot of depression and can have a very high risk of suicide. Another disorder that can have a lot of depression with it is post-traumatic stress disorder. And we call it PTSD. What causes PTSD? Trauma. So if you've been abused, if you've been traumatized, you've been raped, you've been beaten, you've been traumatized and hurt in some way, this is a mental illness that develops because of severe trauma. And people who go through trauma like that emotionally will often go through a significant amount of depression. So if you know people who have suffered serious trauma in their life, it's really important to help them learn how to not just work through, talk about the trauma, to discuss it with people, preferably get some counseling, professional counseling for it, but also recognize that anybody carrying a heavy load as a result of trauma in your past can be very prone to suffer depression. So that's another example. In my counseling work, I work with a lot of people who were severely abused and traumatized. And they'll often struggle with depression. Why? Why do you think trauma would cause a lot of depression? Well, you know, you lose hope. If you learn you can't trust adults because they hurt you, if you learn that your husband beat you, if you learn whatever it might be, you lose hope. You lose any sense of power. You feel weak. You feel unable to help yourself. You feel hopeless about the future. But also often there's just severe impact on the body and the emotion. So this is another type of mental illness that's really a result of trauma and suffering, or it could be neglect that will carry a lot of depression with it. There are a few other mental illness type disorders. One I put on there is called chronic depression. This is severe genetic depression where people just, they have to be on serious medication. They need medical treatment and professional counseling because they're just beaten down so low, bad genetics, bad life, that they literally are powerless to help themselves. And this happens. They can only help themselves gradually over time with professional help, medication, things like that. One of the men that I've seen for a number of years in counseling, he'd attempted suicide something like 8 or 9 times in his life. A grown man, has a career, was married with several children, but he was so severely depressed that he just couldn't help himself, and he tried suicide multiple times. And he started seeing me a number of years ago, and with counseling and getting him on the right medications and things like that, I still see him regularly because he's so prone to get depressed very quickly. but he really is able to live a much more normal life now than he was able to do before. So sometimes you'll see other mental disorders that do affect, that do cause or make depression worse. Another one I've already mentioned, substance abuse and addictions, alcohol, drugs, things like that, medications, people misusing medications can cause serious depression. And so whenever you're trying to help somebody who's depressed, ask them questions. How much do you drink? Are you doing any drugs? If you are, what drugs are you doing? Ask questions. Because at that point, it's the chemical that's causing the depression. If I handed out a bunch of alcohol to all of us in this room and we all started drinking, we would all end up depressed. Not necessarily because we're prone to depression naturally, but because that's what alcohol does to the body. Well, substance abuse is like that. Some of the addictions can be like that too. So if we're addicted to pornography, for instance, something like that over time is going to cause depression because it's an addiction that's constantly being fed, never satisfies, and a person spirals down. Remember, depression is like a downward spiral, feeling worse and worse about themselves because of their addictive behavior. So substance abuse from a medication and an addiction side can also cause a lot of depression. Now, what are the, when they survey people who are suicidal, and you ask yourself, okay, so we have depressed people. Maybe we have two people that are depressed, and I want to help both of them, but which of the depressed person is more at risk to try suicide? And it's the person who feels hopeless and helpless. These are always the two key words. That depressed people, when the more they feel this way, the more at risk they are to become suicidal. Why do you think that is? Why are these two things so important? If you have no hope, where's your escape? How do you ever get out of it? So it gives like no way out. There's just no door I can go through to build a different life for myself. With helpless, it's a fatalism. Just, oh well, nothing I can do. And often when people get to where they're helpless, they think they can predict the future. They do a lot of predicting. It'll never get any better. Nothing can ever help me. Aren't they predicting the future there? I've looked in the future and I've decided there's nothing I can ever do. It'll never get any better. Well, when you're convincing yourself that your future is all bad, how motivated are you to keep living? And so again, if you're working with people who are depressed and you're hearing this kind of hopeless, there's just no way out, there's nothing able to do, or helpless, like, it'll always be this way, it'll never change, then you know somebody's in a very serious level of depression. Pay attention. They're in trouble. Hope is a funny thing. When people have been abused a lot as kids growing up, what do they learn about hope? You know, if my dad is an alcoholic And when he comes home from work and he's drunk, he yells at the family, he beats the family, or he hurts everybody, or he stays at the bar all night and never comes home, and I'm worried about him. What is it? I'm a child in that environment. What do I learn about hope? Well, I hope today when daddy comes home from work, he'll be okay. He'll feel, you know, he won't be drinking. He won't be drunk. He'll come home and we can have a nice evening at home. And dad comes home drunk again. Maybe not every night, but often enough that I get my hopes up. It looks like he's getting better. And then boom, it happens all over again. What do you learn about hope when you live that way? You know, when you start feeling more hope up here, we're feeling better, and then it crashes, and there's pain, and there's hurt, and it doesn't seem to do any good. Maybe we go, after a while, we try to convince ourselves, okay, I'm going to have hope again. I want to believe, I want to trust, I want to think things can get better, and then boom, they don't again. Well, we're going to go longer and longer periods where we don't want to hope. It's like hope becomes foolish after a while. Why should I hope? Hoping is foolish. Every time I hope, I get disappointed. It crashes around me. Have you ever heard that kind of talking from people? And so often when people are feeling hopeless, one thing you always want to pay attention to is what's happened in their life. Did they learn through disappointments, through hopes being broken and shattered, that hope is for fools? If you hope, you're just not very smart. Because the more you hope, and then it gets disappointed, the worse it hurts. So if you just quit hoping, if you just expect the worst, then it won't hurt as bad when the bad happens. Have you ever heard that logic before? Is it true? Is it true that the less you hope, the worse you feel, it hurts less when you suffer? Have any of you ever done a study to see if that's true? Well, the truth is it's a big lie, but it seems so true. The reality is if I hope, even if pain comes, if I hope, according to research anyway, I can handle the conflict, the pain better coming from where I started with hope and now I feel better. And then, okay, I suffer disappointment or hurt. It's still hard. Hurt hurts, right? How do you make hurt not hurt? But hope didn't cause the hurt. Other things caused the hurt, but hope will help us get through it. So the truth of the matter is, every time people think or say, well, you know, the more I hope, the worse it gets. It just makes things more painful. So I'll just quit hoping. I'll just expect the worst. And that way, when the worst happens, it doesn't hurt as much. What is their life like? Well, they're living their life every day depressed and down. And you'll say, well, did something bad happen today? Well, no, but I know it will if I hope too much. So I'll just, if I'm miserable today, I'll handle something painful better tomorrow. Right? Is that true? If I'm miserable today, does that make tomorrow better when I suffer? Well, the truth is not at all, quite the opposite. Now, none of us want to suffer, but if we start from a position of hope to begin with, we have more resilience. We have more ability to handle conflict and trouble than if we're just going through life, well, I'm going to be depressed today. I'm going to be hopeless today. Because that'll help my miserable life tomorrow hurt less. Does that make sense? You'll hear this logic a lot, especially when people were hurt like this growing up as children, or maybe they've been in an abusive marriage, or maybe they're, you know, they've suffered a lot in their life. They've been traumatized. Remember the PTSD, they've gone through trauma as adults. They'll eventually learn that hope is for fools. But it isn't. That's not true. That's a lie that people begin to believe. From a mental health standpoint, when you hear people using that kind of logic, it's really important to begin to challenge it. Now, you don't challenge it by saying, that's not true, knock it off. That's not helping them. But getting them to think about it and asking questions and probing a little bit to get them to think about hope differently can begin to help them gradually. I do this in counseling a lot. So if you're depressed and miserable today, it'll help tomorrow be better. Is that right? Is that what you're telling me? And what do you think most people do when I say it that way? They kind of laugh and they say, well, when you put it that way, it doesn't sound so good. Right? Because if I'm miserable today and then I come and then my wife yells at me tomorrow, I'll handle it better. My wife doesn't yell at me. That's just an example. But anyway, you know, if I'm miserable today, then my boss yelling at me tomorrow will hurt less. Well, that just doesn't work. It doesn't work. So these two things, hopeless and helpless, are so important. Some religions of the world really encourage helplessness, fatalism. Just give up. Just let it happen. You can't influence things. Just life happens and then you die. Any of you heard that quote? It just, there's nothing you can do about it. It just is what it is. That helplessness, how motivated are you to try something when you have a belief system like that? Why bother? Well, if it's what God wants, if it's the way life is, whatever. So these are very dangerous things, and when you run into them with people, it's really important, number one, to think about them, and number two, look for ways to help to begin to challenge people to change those around, those beliefs around into something healthier. So what are your questions on this? Anybody have any questions on this? Are you depressed? Hope doesn't help. Life will never be any better. Anybody feeling better right now? You can see why depression becomes a serious problem. If this is the world you live in, the spiral just keeps pulling us down. How do we get ourselves out of it? Questions on that? Yeah, if parents gave positive messages, it tends to help a lot. It tends to help somebody grow into an adult themselves who has at least a little more hope or optimism. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
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 Right. Are more prone to depression and this, absolutely. If you have parents who are never satisfied, they're perfectionistic, you never do things right, no matter how hard you try, you get criticized, it creates the same. Well, you go either, why try? Or you go the other way, and, oh no, I've got to try extra hard, and you become more and more driven. But that will very much lead to depression because now you're not satisfied with your life. You're striving. And when people are trying to please other people, when they let up being a people pleaser, trying to make people around them happy and do what they can to make others happy, they're not drawing in from any kind of inner strength. They're waiting for somebody outside to approve them. So, yes, research very much shows that as parents, and those of you who are parents or look forward to being parents, the more you can build in your children a positive worldview belief, the more you're going to help them through the depression or the hard times of life in a more hopeful way. Yeah, you go through hard times. Hard things happen. But you can get through it, and you can do things about it. Is that what you're asking? So, yeah, instilling things like that help strengthen people. In the field of psychology, through the last number of years, there's been a lot of tests developed to test for psychological problems, mental disorders, marriage tests, and tests for intelligence, children, adolescents. A lot of different tests have been developed and studies have been done. And and what they keep finding in study after study is there are five things that keep rising to the surface as the most important. If these five things are in with people, they are going to live happier, higher quality life. And the first one is social. People who are connected to other people, the opposite of being lonely or isolating or not connecting with people. People who try to make friendships and relationships. This isn't on your outline. I'm making this up as I go here. But people who are connected with other people and optimistic and hopeful do better in life than those who are more isolated or withdrawn. And this is an interesting one because some people are more introverted and some are more extroverted. Do you know what introversion and extroversion is? Yes or no? Okay. So people who are more introverted are naturally less social. They're not as talkative to as many people. They don't need to be always socially busy. I'm a strong extrovert. I want to talk all the time and be around people. An introvert isn't like that. But the reality is, even if you're an introvert, the more you connect with other people, the higher your happiness and quality of life is going to be. So be an introvert who involves themselves with other people, family, friends, goes to church, has friends, does things, even if it's not constant. I would like something constant. Even if it's not like that, still being social, people who are social do better in all aspects of life. The O is for optimistic. People who have a positive worldview do better across the board in all areas of life. And the sense of hope, we were talking about hope, sense of life can be good and I can have a good day and let me figure out how to go on out and have a good day. People who have that kind of optimism and hope are able to get out and make life better for themselves, have a higher quality of life. P would stand for power, the ability, the belief that I can make my world, I can influence. This is the opposite of helpless, where I can turn around and make my life work better. The E is extroversion. So even though I'm social, the reality is extroverts tend to have less depression than introverts. What does that mean? That it's better to be an extrovert than an introvert? No, not at all. What it means, though, is extroverts are, it's more natural for us to go out and get things in life that we're looking for. So an introvert just has to be willing to look at it, to be willing to do something about it, get out and connect. The C is for conventional. By that means there's a sense of, or control would be another word, the ability to influence my life and make choices that will make my life what I would like for it to be. These five things, on every test that's been developed in psychology for decades, these same five areas or traits keep coming to the surface as the best way to predict a person being enjoying life and feeling good about their life. And so what's happened in the field of psychology is we've had to go back to every test we developed and pull out the questions on the tests that measure for these five and create a special scale just to show where these five stand on every test, because it's such a good predictor of people who are going to feel good about their life and enjoy their lives. It comes up over and over and over again. None of them are very complicated, are they? They're kind of basic. Get out there and be with people. Connect with people. Be more outgoing in terms of how you share your life with people. Express yourself. Know you can make your life the way you want it to make it. Have hope or optimism and belief that you can make a better life for yourself. It all seems kind of like common sense. And it seems like, well, it can't be that easy. It sounds too simple. But the reality is the research keeps showing these five things are critical over and over, test after test. Whatever the tests are measuring, intelligence, marriage, personality, mental illness, the same five scales are more and more important. And so every test maker has had to go back and create this scale in order to standardize the tests to be able to measure for these five things. Which means the better people do these things, the less depressed they're going to be. The worse they are at more of them, the more depressed they'll be. The extroversion, introversion is an example of that. I'm an extrovert, very strong extrovert. If I stay by myself very much, what do you think happens to me? I'm getting depressed, and it's actually kind of driving myself crazy. I don't even like being with myself. I need to get out and be around people because I drive myself crazy. So an extrovert who's too isolated is going to be significantly depressed. An introvert can enjoy their time alone and being with themselves, which is great. God made them that way. But if they do too much of that, it can lead into an isolation that becomes more and more unhealthy. So they don't need to become as extroverted as I am, but they do need to be able to get out and connect with people, even whether they want to or not. Does that make sense? That's not on your outline. I just threw that in there. So number four, we're going to start, and I want to save most of this for tomorrow, so we'll spend time, more deliberately going through this. But I want to talk about suicide more specifically. Depression, mental illness, addictions, alcohol, all of these things contribute to people becoming suicidal. So that's why we've been talking about these things tonight. But suicide, really, how does a person go from just being depressed to actually being actively suicidal? And you'll see the five steps, the kind of progressive steps that people tend to take who become more and more suicidal. Initially, they just wish they were dead. I'm just so sick of this life. I just want to get out of here. Let me go away. I just want to quit, I'm just tired of life. At this point, they don't want to kill themselves. They're not thinking, I want to end my life. They're just thinking, life is so hard, I just want to quit living life. As a Christian, I read the Bible a lot, and there's a lot of examples of this in the Bible. People like Job and David and some of the heroes of the faith who just got so down that they just felt like, you know, what's the point? God, why did you create me? Why am I living here? What's the point? I just don't want to live anymore. And this is like the early stages. And when you hear people talking and thinking that way and talking about it, be concerned. Pay attention. They're letting you know that there's a part of them that's losing a grip on their purpose and reason and value of life. So they're, and we're going to review some of this a little more tomorrow and move on, but I wanted to highlight some of this yet tonight. So the reality is when people want to die, they're not actively trying to kill themselves, but they're giving up on life. And a lot of people do this, what I call passive suicide. It's like they're not going to actively try to kill themselves, but they, because they feel so hopeless and are just kind of giving up, they do things that they know are bad for themselves, but it's like they don't care. And in fact, they kind of hope it'll cause them to die sooner. You know, if I keep smoking cigarette, eventually I know a cigarette will kill me. Or if I keep overeating, eventually if I eat the wrong stuff, or if I engage in risky behavior, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow, but do risky things, eventually, hopefully, now they may not say it that way, but hopefully I'll die sooner. And so I call that passive suicide. They're not actively trying to kill themselves, but because they want to die and they know it's not right to kill themselves, they'll do things that are really an attempt to shorten their life. Does that make sense? I have a client now who's a young man. He's from, he's about 25. And when I started seeing him, and I'm getting his history, finding out what's gone on and what his life's been, found out that he'd attempted suicide two different times. And really had tried to kill himself. He really worked at it. And then I said, and he'd had several hospitalizations, some years of counseling, nothing had helped him. And I said, why are you here now to see me? And he said, I realize now that I convinced myself I was depressed, but I really wasn't. But I made myself believe I was. Which is interesting. Young people will do that. They'll sometimes convince themselves of a thought process and believe it about himself. And he said, yeah, I just thought my life, I didn't like my life, and so I figured I was just depressed, and so I just was giving up on life. Now, his father beat him. His mother didn't protect him. He was neglected. Both mom and dad would work out of the home, and he would literally be home by himself. He'd have to get himself ready to go to school, and then when he came home, no parent was there. And then when dad came home mad and whatever, he'd beat him up. Nobody would ever call the police or protect him, and his mom wouldn't protect him either, would never tell dad, knock it off. And so he had a really tough life, and a lot of really hard things had happened to him. But he said, because of all that, because of how hard his life was, I convinced myself I was depressed, and so I figured I should kill myself. Well, he did a bunch of other risky behaviors. He tried to kill himself twice directly. Other times, he did all kinds of risky behaviors as a way of kind of passive suicide. Like, if I die, at least it doesn't look like suicide. It looks more legitimate. Like getting in a car and driving crazy fast all through corners. He explained one thing he did that I couldn't even understand what he was saying. It took me a while. But he said, I called it around the world. I said, what's around the world? He said he got in his car. He was driving like 40 or 50 miles an hour. What would that be in kilometers?
80.
About 80 kilometers an hour. He's driving the car. He would open the windows on both sides, the driver's side and on the passenger side, and he would crawl out. He would set the car, and he would crawl out of the driver's side window with the car going 80 kilometers an hour, go over the top of the car and go in the passenger side before he came back in and grabbed the steering wheel. Have any of you ever heard that before? I found it so bizarre. I've been counseling 35 years. Sometimes I think I've heard everything, and then I hear something I never heard before. And it's like, how did you come up with that? Well, it just seemed cool. Well, that's what I'm calling passive suicide. It's actually nuts, but that's separate, crazy behavior. But he didn't do it to kill himself. He didn't say, I want to do that so I could die. He said somehow it would be cool. But really, it was a passive attempt at suicide. So when people want to die, they wish they were dead. They don't see any point in living. That becomes a passive kind of suicide attempt. The next step is they begin to actually think, I want to kill myself. I want to end my life. I don't want to just die. Now I'm willing to think about maybe I should do something myself. And that's a big change. It's a big shift from passive suicide to thinking about a more active suicide, specific steps that I might take. And by the way, young children can think this way. It's really scary. You can have an 88-year-old thinking this way. Lori back there tomorrow is going to talk to you. She's a trained social worker and works at our church with a children program, and she deals with this working with youth and these things literally every day, and she's going to share with you some insights tomorrow. And you can ask her stories about that and from a church context as well. But anyway, beginning to think, I want to die. I want to end my life. I don't want to live anymore, but I'm not dying soon enough, so I'm going to help myself die sooner. And that thought of beginning to want to kill themselves comes in. The next step then is they begin to make a plan. Well, I want to kill myself. How am I going to do it? And so they actually begin to develop a plan or thought in their mind of how they want to do this. And so it's the, I want to die, I want to kill myself. How am I going to do it? What steps can I take? And so maybe I want to take pills. Maybe I want to drive the car off a cliff somewhere, where they begin to come up with an actual plan. And then the next step is preparing, where they have a plan. Now they're going to try to create the situation so they can implement the plan they developed. So they're preparing. They're getting everything in order and in place for the actual attempt. And then the last step is they actually attempt suicide. Now, remember what I said. For every one suicide, there's 20 or 25 attempted suicide where people live through it. Either they back off at the last minute or they try and it doesn't kill them or whatever. So the number of attempts is in the thousands every year of people. So they make an actual attempt to kill themselves. So these are like the five progressive steps to go deeper and deeper into suicidal thinking. And tomorrow we're going to break these out in more detail and we'll go through the outline more. And I have a section tomorrow morning. I want to talk about some of the myths around suicide. And we're going to talk about how the progression of depression and thinking and going through these five stages looks and what can we do to help people who are going in that. Now, do I have you all depressed tonight? Is everybody feeling depressed? I hope not. We're trying to help all of us understand better for ourselves and our loved ones, but also be able to help people around us. That when we see these signs, when we hear these things, when we experience these kinds of things, that we can turn around and know how to help people. So I want to stop here for tonight. Let me see if any of you have any questions, concerns, any of that. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to talk about that tomorrow. So we unfortunately had an example of that calm at our church recently. So I'll use that as an example. We're going to talk tomorrow about when people begin to come out of the depression and give a real sense of calm. I'm fine. Everything's wonderful. And they're suicidal. That's very scary. Why? Well, because preparing, remember stage four here, they prepared. Everything's in order. And that's why it's so scary. They're ready to make it happen. And I'll give you one quick story tonight. I was counseling a woman who was married and had three kids. And her husband was an abusive alcoholic. So he'd coming home drunk, beating them all. She had two daughters and one son. And she was realizing she hadn't protected her children, and she had let her husband go unchallenged, and he'd been abusing all of them, her, the wife, and all three of the kids. And it was just a bad, bad situation. And so she said, I think I would like for you to see my kids once or twice, because this has got to be bothering them. I had been helping her with her own depression. I said, okay, I'll meet with your kids. Tell me about them. Well, the oldest kid was a daughter who was fighting with dad constantly, yelling. He'd hit her. She'd hit back, pushing, shoving, being very confrontive and aggressive. The middle daughter was a star. She was a star athlete, had straight A's at, highest grades at school. She was very pretty, had lots of boys interested in her. She went active in the youth group at the church that they went to. She was doing everything, really excelling. The third was a son who was an alcoholic. He kept using drugs. He had multiple incarcerations where he got jailed for multiple legal offenses. So she described these three kids to me in order. And she said, which one would I like to see first? Who would I first like to meet with? Who do you think I told her? The middle. I said, I want to see your middle daughter first. She said, what? She's the one who's doing great. The other two are terrible. I said, well, I want to start with her. Her name was Lisa. So I said, I want to see Lisa next time. The next time, Mom brought Lisa with her. Lisa was probably 15 or 16. And we talked a little bit, and then the mom waited out in the waiting room, and I brought Lisa back into my office, and we sat down. She was very friendly, very pleasant. And I said, Lisa, have you thought recently about killing yourself? That was my opening question. She looked at me and her eyes got really big. She said, what did you say? And I said, tell me about it. Tell me about how you were going to kill yourself. And she said, how did you know? And I said, tell me what the plan is. Well, the night before she saw me, she and a girlfriend of hers had met to both kill themselves. They had met at the girlfriend's house. They had laid all these pills out that they were each going to take to kill themselves. And just before they did it, the mom came home early from work. They weren't expecting her, so they quickly hid everything. And after she saw me that day, they were going to meet at the girlfriend's house and kill themselves that very night. And she was shocked that I knew. Well, why did I know? She was the perfect cover-up. The other two were angry, but they were showing all their anger. by confronting dad, going to jail, breaking laws, doing drugs. They were all acting out, but she was the perfect one. Everything was just right. And so I said, you know, we have to tell your mom this, that you're planning on, you tried to kill yourself yesterday and you're planning on killing yourself this afternoon. And she said, I know you do. So I said, do you want to be in here with me when I tell her? Or do you want to tell her yourself and we'll have her join us? Or do you want me to tell her, but you're going to sit in the room while I tell her, your mom? She said, no, I want you to bring mom in and you tell her, but I want to be in the room. I want to watch her reaction. So I got the mom in and I told the mom, you need to know that Lisa's planning on killing herself this afternoon. Can you imagine how the mom felt? She was completely stunned. She had no idea. It was all so well hidden. And the mom was completely shocked. And so then I had Lisa explain the whole thing to mom. And then, of course, the mom knew, but I said, now, you know, you need to tell her best friend's mom that her daughter is planning on killing herself too. And so that mom, while I was still in the office talking to Lisa a little bit, she went out and used her cell phone and called the other mom and told her what they were, Lisa and her daughter were planning. That's an example of when things are perfect. Scary. What's interesting in that case, part of why I like to use that example, is because I saw Lisa a number of years later. She came back as an adult woman. She was married and had a kid, and her life was struggling. But what counselor did she want to see? She came to me. I mean, I'm the one who busted it, but because she knew I cared, and because she lived, because of what we talked about, she, years later, chose to come back and see me for other things. So it was just a real encouragement to see when you help people through a hard time, how they can appreciate it and change. But sometimes you have to be very, very careful when everything looks too good. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. Any other questions? Yes. That's a great question. Are there any other personality traits that would predispose people? And again, remember the scope I wrote up here, people that are isolated. You know, so if you're introverted and isolated, that would be personality traits not going to cause depression or suicidal, but it puts you more at risk. Some people are optimistic and some are pessimistic, right? If I did a survey, how many of you see a glass half full of water, and how many see a glass half empty? Remember the optimism. People who say, oh, it's half full, tend to have a little better quality of life than the people who say it's half empty. Well, that's a personality trait. Some people are just a little more optimistic and others a little more pessimistic. Again, that won't cause suicidal thinking, but you have to learn to discipline your mind to be able to not just see things in a pessimistic way, but also balance it. So those are some basic examples. But the main trait of concern to pay attention to is depression, like I said. And if you have a tendency because of biology toward depression, like my wife and I have a daughter that way, you have to really make sure that they understand that and take good positive steps. Anything else for tonight? We'll go over more of this tomorrow. If you want to finish your test, if you didn't get all the way through it, you can finish that tonight or tomorrow. And tomorrow afternoon, we'll take the time and go through each question. And I think by then it'll be easy for you. Maybe it didn't feel so easy when you were first taking it. I don't know. Well, thank you all for your patience tonight. Yes. Oh, sorry. Say that again.
How do you go to work every day knowing you're going to hear all the time?
Oh. She asks hard questions. Somebody tell her she's not allowed to ask any questions. Yeah. 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 Yeah, so you heard her question. How do I get tired of hearing all these horrible stories and want to cry my eyes out and go home and get depressed? And my answer is never. I never have. Why? Well, if I saw everybody all day long miserable, yeah, I'd be miserable. But you know what? After people get counseling and help, they get better. So in a day, I might have two or three people who are really struggling, but a couple others who are getting better. They used to struggle and they don't so much. But my favorite thing is I get to go to my car and drive home to my wonderful wife and my life. And I love that because I tell myself, okay, I've been helping people with their life and I hear lots of horrible things every day or week. But now I get to go home to my good life and enjoy my life. And I think the more I enjoy my life, the better I'll be able to help somebody who's struggling. There are times you do want to weep. I mean, you hear the most horrible things. Many, many things I never tell my wife because I don't want to bring those things home. They're so heavy. They're so dark that, my wife and I live a good life. We don't need to bring them back into the house with us. But that's always a great experience. I get to go home and live my life. So I've helped people with some really hard things. But now I get to go home and play with the kids and be with my wife and eat a nice dinner and play with the kids or go for a walk or whatever it might be. But anyway, you ask hard questions. Anything else? Russ, Jason, anything you want to close with?
Thanks, Doug. I hope that is helpful. I hope it's, it's a lot of information to take in and to process. Hopefully you don't feel overwhelmed. Hopefully you feel encouraged. And we'll come back tomorrow and learn some more and learn how to apply some of these things. So tomorrow, just a reminder, we're going to start at 10 a.m., here again, and also don't forget to either bring a lunch or else you'll have to just eat biscuits or walk to Dunn's. So, that's it for today, and we will see you all in the morning.